Good morning. Thank you for joining today. My name is Dan Chang. I am a radiation oncologist at Stanford University. I'm here to give a talk on upper GI cancers, the evolving landscape for radiotherapy. I want to thank the organizers for this meeting for, one, for being able to find a way to still make this meeting happen, despite all of the uncertainty and unpredictability that's been going on out there. I want to thank all of you for joining and tuning in and for being flexible with this new format. So thank you very much. I gave this talk last year in New Orleans, and it was a lot of fun, and I was looking forward to doing it in this year. I'm sure as all of you were looking forward to joining us there, but you know, I'm still very happy to be here to be able to give this talk today. Here are my disclosures. And today the learning objectives will be to apply recent data in the treatment of esophageal cancer, evaluate the current role of radiotherapy for gastric cancer, identify how to use radiation with current systemic therapy for resectable and borderline resectable pancreatic cancer, and to determine the appropriate circumstances to use radiation for biliary tract cancers. So we'll start with esophageal cancer. So we'll first start with the topic of preoperative chemo radiation. The current standard of care was defined by the CROSS trial, which was a Dutch trial first published in 2012, randomizing 366 patients with T2 to T3, N0 to N1 esophageal or GE junction cancer. They were randomized to either surgery alone or to preoperative carboplatin with 41.4 gray in 23 fractions, followed then by surgery. The R0 resection rate was significantly higher in the preoperative therapy arm at 92% versus 69% for surgery alone. The pathologic complete response rate was 29% overall, with 49% path CR in the squamous cell carcinoma subgroup and 23% for the adenocarcinoma. Similar 30-day mortality, 3% versus 2%. And the overall survival was better for preoperative chemo radiation with an over doubling of the median overall survival of 49.4 months versus 24 months. And those results held up in the 2015 update of this trial, 48.6 months versus 24 months. And here are the survival curves, and you can see that by histology, the greatest benefit was seen between the squamous cell carcinoma preoperative therapy arm, here in the dashed blue, versus surgery alone for squamous cell carcinoma in the dashed red. And the adenocarcinoma group, which is represented by the solid lines, there was a smaller benefit seen. Looking at patterns of failure, preoperative chemoradiation actually improved local, regional, and distant progression. However, on subgroup analysis, by looking at histology, chemo radiation significantly improved survival for squamous cell carcinoma histology, but for adenocarcinoma, that difference actually fell to be non-significant at 0.059. And critics of this trial have pointed to this lack of a benefit for adenocarcinoma, suggesting that perhaps chemotherapy alone may be an appropriate standard of care. And there have been trials comparing preoperative chemotherapy versus chemo radiation. And here's an example of one where the results actually were negative. And so this has actually led to a debate about whether to use perioperative chemotherapy versus preoperative chemo radiation. And there have actually been two trials that have shown significant improvement in survival with perioperative chemotherapy. The most recent is the FLOT4 trial, which was published last year. This trial actually randomized 56% of patients who had GE junction cancers, and they were treated with either the MAGIC regimen of ECF or ECX chemotherapy, or 4 cycles of FLOT before surgery and 4 cycles of FLOT after surgery. And you can see that the FLOT4 arm actually had significant improvement over the historic MAGIC regimen. Also, a French trial published nearly 10 years ago also randomized patients to perioperative chemotherapy versus surgery alone. And that trial showed improvement in survival of perioperative chemo radiation. So the question is how does chemotherapy compare to chemo radiation? And perhaps the one trial that you can use to really support the role of preoperative chemo radiation over chemo is the POET trial. Unfortunately, it was a smaller trial, only 119 patients with distal or GE junction adenocarcinomas, T4, T3 to T4NX, randomized either cisplatin-5-FU leucovorin for 15 weeks or cisplatin-5-FU leucovorin for 12 weeks, followed then by chemo radiation. Unfortunately, the chemotherapy that they used was only 30 gray in 15 fractions, which we would pretty much consider to be a very weak chemoradiation regimen. However, the results were quite interesting. Although the R0 resection rate was no different, the path CR rate still significantly favored the chemoradiation arm, 14% versus 2%. The overall survival strongly favored preoperative chemoradiation over chemotherapy alone, for nearly 40% versus 24%, but the p-value was only 0.055. Again, a very small trial of only 119 patients. Local failure rate was lower with chemoradiation, as well as the distant metastases rate. What was significant was the local progression-free survival, 0.01. So we hope to actually have the answer to this question with several upcoming trials that are asking the question of preoperative chemoradiation or perioperative chemo. There's the ESOPEC trial looking at adenocarcinomas of cross versus perioperative FLOT4, the NEO-AEGIS trial taking adenocarcinomas of the esophagus or G junction cross versus perioperative chemo. RACE trial, similar preoperative chemoradiation followed by FLOT4 or just FLOT4. Top Gear trial, which is nearly done with accrual, and this is randomizing patients to a perioperative chemo regimen or one that integrates preoperative chemoradiation. And then finally, the CRITICS II trial, which is looking at preoperative chemotherapy regimens or integrating cross into the preoperative regimen. So moving on to the next big topic is definitive chemoradiation and the question of dose escalation. Now, for a long time, we've known that chemoradiation is a standard of care in the definitive setting, and this was defined by the historic RTOG 8501 trial, which looked at 64 Gray alone versus 50 Gray with cisplatin 5-FU, and this showed a significant improvement in 5 years overall survival, favoring the chemoradiation arm. So the next question that was asked was dose escalation with chemoradiation, and this was asked in the Intergroup 0123 trial. And this randomized patients to 64.8 Gray with cisplatin 5-FU or standard 50.4 Gray cisplatin 5-FU. What they found was that there was a higher rate of death in the patients randomized to the high dose arm. However, what was strange was that 7 out of these 11 deaths actually occurred before patients actually received any type of dose escalation. So that was quite puzzling. However, when they looked at the percent of patients with persistent or local regional recurrence, they found that there was no difference between the high dose versus the low dose arm. And when you look specifically at survival by either intention to treat or dose received, there was not any real hint of any improvement with dose escalation. So that's really perplexed our field for a long time because we couldn't quite understand these results. With such a high rate of persistent disease or local regional failure, why wouldn't high dose radiation improve outcomes? But for a long time, we haven't really had any data to help better understand this or to ask this question until more recently. Until recently, a randomized trial was conducted in China, which randomized patients with esophageal squamous cell carcinoma to modern chemoradiation with IMRT to 60 Gray versus 50 Gray. Chemotherapy was cisplatin and docetaxel, followed by consolidation chemotherapy. So this was the first trial since the Intergroup 0123 trial to really ask the question of dose escalation. Here, you can see that there was reasonable balance between the two treatment arms, and you can see that compliance was generally overall good, but was slightly favored the standard dose arm. Chemotherapy as well was generally similar, but slightly favored the standard dose arm. When you look specifically at the endpoints of local regional progression-free survival, overall progression-free survival, and overall survival, unfortunately, there was no significant difference in any of these endpoints by high dose versus low dose. If you look further at the patterns of failure, you can see that even with high dose radiation, there was no difference in local regional relapse or in in-field failures. What we did see, though, that there was no difference in toxicities either with high dose chemoradiation as well. So this was one trial that also supported the findings of the Intergroup 0123 trial. A third trial was recently presented at GI ASCO just about 2 months ago, the Art Deco trial, which was a Dutch trial randomizing patients with T2 to T4a, N0 to N3, adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma. You can see that about two-thirds of patients were squamous cell, and they were randomized to either 50.4 gray with chemotherapy, carboplatin, or with dose escalation with simultaneous integrated boost up to 61.6 gray at 2.2 gray per fraction. And you can see here that the fields that were used and how radiation was conducted. Looking at local progression by histologic type, you can see that squamous cell carcinoma did slightly better, but it was not significant. The 3-year local progression-free survival was 77% versus 62%. And when you look specifically by histology, by treatment arm, there was no difference in any of these curves. You can see that the squamous cell arms are the slightly higher two arms, and the adenocarcinoma arms are the slightly lower arms. Most importantly, you can see that for overall survival, there was no difference in survival between the high dose versus the standard dose. In fact, the standard dose arm is the blue line, which is actually slightly higher. There was no significant difference, though, in toxicity between the two arms. So we now have three trials that have failed to show any benefit both in local regional progression or in overall survival with dose escalation. So my esophageal cancer takeaway points are preoperative chemoradiotherapy is a standard of care for both adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma. Perioperative chemotherapy is an alternative acceptable strategy for adenocarcinomas, but we will have some upcoming trials that will determine how these regimens compare. And there is no benefit to dose escalation above 50 gray for definitive chemoradiation. So these were our treatment recommendations that I presented at last year's meeting. I said for preoperative chemoradiation for all resectable patients, we would still use standard 45 and 50 gray in 25 fractions. 45 gray would go to the GTV with a 3 to 4 centimeter mucosal margin, covering as well some of the elective nodes for upper tumors, covering the supraclav, and for distal tumors, covering the celiac nodes, with an SIB boost to the GTV. However, what I said last year was for definitive chemoradiation, we would do 45 gray, similar volumes, and 50 gray SIB only for squamous cell carcinomas. But for adenocarcinomas, the thinking being that it was more radioresistant, we would still consider boosting from 54 gray up to 60 gray. However, in light of the Art Deco trial, I would probably remove that one qualifier and just use 50 gray in 25 fractions, regardless of histology, adenocarcinoma, or squamous cell carcinoma. So moving on to gastric, for many years, the intergroup trial or the McDonald trial set the standard of postoperative chemoradiation for patients in the United States who underwent gastrectomy. These patients were randomized to either no adjuvant therapy or postoperative chemoradiation with 5-FU leucovorin and 45 gray of radiation. And this trial showed a significant benefit, both in overall survival and in relapse-free survival for postoperative chemoradiation. These results did hold on the 10-year update, but what they added was that on subgroup analysis, adjuvant chemoradiation only improved patients' outcome who had intestinal subtype histology. For diffuse type, there was no significant benefit seen. And this trial has been heavily criticized because patients in this trial, very few of them actually received a D2 lymph node dissection. And so the thinking was that postoperative chemoradiation may have just made up for very poor surgery. In Asia, where D2 dissections is the standard of care and has been for a long time, adjuvant chemotherapy has actually been their standard of care as well. So the ARTIST trial was actually a trial conducted from South Korea where they examined the question of postoperative chemoradiation compared to chemotherapy. And so they randomized patients to, in the adjuvant setting, a sandwich regimen of cisplatin-Xeloda for 2 cycles, followed by chemoradiation, and then 2 more cycles of cisplatin-Xeloda versus 6 cycles of cisplatin-Xeloda alone. And for overall survival, there was no significant benefit between these two arms. However, on subgroup analysis, they did identify two groups that seemed to benefit from postoperative chemoradiation: those who were lymph node positive and those with intestinal subtype. And so one could have used this trial to support using postoperative chemoradiation for patients with lymph node positive disease or possibly with intestinal subtype. So the same investigators then conducted the ARTIST-2 trial. And in this trial, 900 patients following a D2 resection and lymph node positive disease, so their pathologic stage 2 to 3, were randomized to one of three arms: adjuvant chemotherapy with S1, which is an oral derivative of 5-FU, adjuvant SOX chemotherapy, which is S1 and oxaliplatin for 6 months, or to adjuvant chemoradiation, which was SOX times 2 followed by S1 and concurrent radiation. Radiation was 45 gray and 25 fractions, followed then by 4 more cycles of SOX. And this trial was reported in ASCO in 2019. I have not yet seen it published. These results were presented at ASCO in 2019. I have not yet seen it published. But looking at the primary endpoint of disease-free survival, you can see how all three arms did. The S1 alone chemotherapy arm, you can see, is a solid blue. And then the orange line is SOX, and the purple line is SOX with concurrent RT. And you can see the three-year disease-free survival reported here. The median follow-up was at 37 months. When comparing each of the arms, SOX versus S1, SOX was superior with a hazard ratio of 0.62 and a p-value of 0.0157. SOX with radiation compared to S1, however, despite having a lower hazard ratio of 0.69, the p-value was not quite significant. And when they look further at disease-free survival with subgroups, the SOX or SOX with radiation was superior to S1, but if you look at S1 or SOX versus SOX-RT, this was not statistically significant. Looking specifically at subgroups, there was no clear subgroup that seemed to benefit from adjuvant chemo radiation. Here is the intestinal subgroup, no difference. And if you look at the lymph node burden, pathologic N1 versus N2, you can see that it actually slightly favored the chemotherapy-only arm. So as our last possible indication of adjuvant radiotherapy for lymph node positive disease, this trial has seemed to show that the addition of radiation did not seem to offer a benefit. Now, up until now, we've been talking about adjuvant chemoradiation, but the other standard of care that's been out there has been the MAGIC regimen, which is perioperative chemotherapy, and this was first shown in the MAGIC trial, where patients who were treated with perioperative ECF chemotherapy 3 cycles before and 3 cycles after surgery had improved survival over surgery alone. So the question that was asked from the CRITICS trial, which was published a couple years back, looked at perioperative ECX or EOX chemotherapy pre and post surgery, or preoperative ECX or EOX followed by surgery, and then postoperative chemoradiation. So this trial is asking, what about substituting postoperative chemoradiation in combination with preoperative chemotherapy? And this trial was published, and it showed that there was no benefit to overall survival with the addition of chemoradiation. And in fact, the survival was slightly worse. And you look specifically at event-free survival, again, no difference. Looking at the subgroups, there's no clear subgroup that seemed to benefit from the addition of radiation. But I still have a few lingering questions, which are, what about patients with lymph node positive disease after chemotherapy? I'd be curious to see how this group would have done with postoperative radiation, because that group was not presented or called out in the publication. And also, what about the poor path responders, patients who failed to respond or have a good response to chemotherapy? Does it make sense to give them continued chemotherapy that didn't seem to work? Or did those patients benefit from switching gears and giving postoperative chemoradiation? So we hope to see that in an upcoming update of that trial. And as mentioned, I showed this before, but we do have 5 upcoming trials that hopefully may answer the question of perhaps moving chemoradiation in the preoperative setting. Perhaps we may see a benefit in that situation. But my gastric cancer takeaway points are perioperative chemotherapy or adjuvant chemotherapy are the standard of care for gastric cancer. The role of adjuvant chemoradiation, which years ago was the standard of care, is now, I would say, currently undefined. Possibly the only indication left may be for patients with positive margins. And of course, we are waiting for upcoming trials that are testing the role of preoperative chemoradiation, which may hopefully breathe new life into the role of radiation for gastric cancer. So for now, my treatment recommendations are pretty easy. Systemic therapy only. Perhaps we can find a reason to give chemoradiation for patients with margin-positive disease, or possibly for inadequate nodal sampling, or I also may add for patients who may not be able to tolerate chemotherapy. I probably would still consider using chemoradiation. And the radiation would be standard McDonnell regimen, 45 gray and 25 fractions with concurrent 5-FU Rizalota. CTV would include the stomach bed and regional nodes. And if there were a positive margin and I could locate that positive margin well, I may consider trying to boost that area to up to 50 to 54 gray. The third topic is pancreatic cancer. I report here some recent numbers that I saw in a publication earlier this year, looking at the 2020 cancer statistics. And I was actually kind of surprised. Actually, I was pretty much blown away from what I saw. Pancreatic cancer is the 10th most common cancer in men and the 9th most common cancer in women. Total, it is the 10th most common cancer with 57,000 cases. And when I looked this up in 2014, that number was 46,000. So there's been a significant jump over the last half a decade in pancreatic cancer. But what blew me away was when we look at the deaths. For men, it was the number 4 cancer death. For women, it was the number 4 cancer death. But when you add it all together, it was actually the number 3 cause of cancer death at 47,000 cases. Moreover, if you look at the number 2 cause of death, which is colorectal cancer, that was only 53,200, which means that there was only about 6,000 cases separating pancreatic cancer from becoming the number 2 cause of cancer death. And again, looking back in 2014, there were 39,000 deaths from pancreatic cancer. So a rise of almost 8,000 over the last half decade. So the rationale for radiation in pancreatic cancer is, with recent improvements in systemic therapy, there is likely going to be an increased role for local control. We all know local progression has consequences. We've seen patients who have local symptoms that need to be palliated, and we know that local control is poor with non-surgical therapies. And as mentioned, over the years, there have been significant improvements in systemic therapy. FOLFIRINOX and gemcitabine have emerged as standards of care in the locally advanced and in the metastatic setting. So when we turn our attention to resectable disease, so primarily in the adjuvant setting, these are historic trials that have tested postoperative chemo radiation versus either observation or with chemotherapy. The older GITSIG and ERTC trials seem to suggest a benefit for postoperative chemo radiation, but the SPAC-1 trial was the key trial that really diminished the role, I would say, of postoperative chemo radiation, because it showed that chemotherapy actually had superiority over chemo radiation. So the standard of care is primarily adjuvant chemotherapy, but more recently, there have been some tremendous improvements in the chemotherapy regimen. The older trials that I showed pretty much just used 5-FU or gemcitabine. So it began with the SPAC-4 trial published a few years back, which showed superiority of combination gemcitabine and camptocytabine versus gemcitabine alone, with a median overall survival of 28 months versus 25.5 months. What's interesting is that patients in this trial, 60% of them who were enrolled had positive margins. And for patients who had R0 resection, there was a much larger improvement seen with the combination chemo. But when you look specifically at patients with R1 resection, you can see that the combination chemotherapy did not seem to improve survival. So I looked at this as a possible role for perhaps using local regional therapy. However, the trial that probably dropped our jaws the most is the PRODIGE 24 trial. This trial, published very recently, randomized patients to adjuvant FOLFIRINOX versus gemcitabine alone. And the results pretty much, they're about as much of a home run as you would ever see in a randomized trial. They reached a median overall survival with adjuvant FOLFIRINOX of 54.4 months compared to 35 months with gemcitabine alone. And these results are noteworthy for a couple reasons. One, you can now actually get over a 4.5 year survival with modified FOLFIRINOX. Those results were unheard of for so many decades until just recently. And it actually has given us hope that we may actually cure patients with pancreatic cancer. The other important finding is the fact that even with gemcitabine alone, the median overall survival was significantly greater than we've seen in past trials of 35 months, so showing that with modern chemotherapy with FOLFIRINOX available as a salvage for relapse, this shows an improvement. You can actually improve outcomes for all patients. And so more recently, just presented last year at ASCO, was the results of the APACT trial. And this was a trial, so very similar design, except they used adjuvant gemabraxane, the other major regimen that's been shown to have improvement in the metastatic setting. So these patients were treated more in the adjuvant setting with gemabraxane versus gemcitabine alone. And what was interesting about this trial is that their primary endpoint was quite different from other trials. They actually used an independently assessed disease-free survival as their primary endpoint. And you can see here that by the independently assessed disease-free survival intention-to-treat population, there was no significant difference in disease-free survival. But when they looked at the pre-specified sensitivity analysis, which was the investigator-assessed disease-free survival, there actually was an improvement in disease-free survival, p-value of 0.017. But more importantly, I think if you look at the secondary endpoint, which was overall survival, which of course is independent of whether you reviewed that centrally or by investigator, you can see that adjuvant gemabraxane improved overall survival with a p-value of 0.045. However, since this was not their primary endpoint, the conclusions were actually a little bit softer than I was actually expecting. They concluded that for the primary endpoint of independently assessed disease-free survival, the primary endpoint was not met. However, the APAC trial is the first trial of adjuvant therapy for pancreatic cancer to use independently assessed disease-free survival. But when you look at the investigator-assessed survival, disease-free survival, they seem to align more closely with the overall survival results. Consistent with the BRODISH trial, improved survival with gem monotherapy suggests better patient selection and benefit of modern chemotherapy options for salvage. And final data on overall survival will clarify the role of gemabraxane. Continued investigation of this regimen is warranted, particularly in those who are not candidates for FOLFIRINOX. So, to me, some softer conclusions, but I do think that this does establish gemabraxane, I should say, as an acceptable standard of care for patients who probably are not candidates for FOLFIRINOX. However, we still don't have an answer for the role of adjuvant chemoradiation. We await the results of the RTOG-0848 trial. This trial is attempting to randomize patients to either 6 cycles of gemcitabine chemotherapy or to 6 cycles of gemcitabine followed then by chemoradiation with concurrent 5-FU or capecitabine. Now, this trial has been amended since PRODISH 24 came out. They do allow adjuvant FOLFIRINOX as well. But hopefully, these results will breathe new life into the role of adjuvant radiation. But I do believe that the field is trending towards another major paradigm shift, which is preoperative chemoradiation or preoperative therapy overall. And the rationale is surgery is curative, yet morbid. We know that. We also know that about 20 to 25% of patients who receive neoadjuvant therapy with chemotherapy do develop systemic disease, and so these patients would not have benefited from an upfront Whipple. Also, what I didn't mention too much was that in the previous trials, the PRODIGE and the SPAC4 trials, the R1 resection rate for patients enrolled was 43 up to 60%. So these were patients that had upfront surgery and still had about a 50% rate of R1 resection, which is no better than a coin flip. So the benefit of preoperative therapy is if you go all in on therapy prior to surgery, you get maximum control of systemic disease, you get the longest interval of time before systemic disease can be declared, and you allow for possible sterilization of margins to increase the rate of R0. So preoperative therapy in particular can be very beneficial for patients with borderline resectable disease. And these are patients with tumors that abut the SMA or the celiac artery by up to 180 degrees, where the potential for a margin negative resection is possible if the patients can get a good response to preoperative therapy. And here I show a few established definitions for borderline resectable disease, but all of them have in common up to 180 degrees of important major blood vessels, including the SMA. Now, the big question is, what is the optimal preoperative treatment? Is it chemotherapy alone, or is it chemo radiation? And unfortunately, we don't have any prospective randomized data to answer this question. What we do have are a number of retrospective and single-arm trials that have asked this question. And here I've compiled the data for chemotherapy in the preoperative setting alone. And you can see under in this red box, these are the median overall survivals of patients who have had resection. And you can see that only a couple studies seem to report that, or at least give numbers. They're about 23 to 27 months, which is about similar to what you would have seen historically in the adjuvant setting. What's compiled here are data published on chemotherapy followed by chemo radiation. And what you can see here in the red box is that the reported median overall survivals of patients with resection, some of these numbers are actually quite favorable, up to 40 months. So although you can't compare these studies directly, certainly there's evidence to suggest that preoperative chemo radiation may be an appropriate standard of care. But what we do have finally, at least, is some very recently hot off the press data. These are the results from the PreOp-PANC trial, which is a phase 3 randomized trial from the Netherlands. This was first reported at ASCO a few years ago, and it's finally been published now. And this is really the first study that actually tests the paradigm of surgery and adjuvant chemo, hit the historical standard, to preoperative therapy followed by surgery, followed by chemotherapy. So patients in the study, about 240 patients or so, were randomized to either surgery and 6 cycles of adjuvant gemcitabine chemotherapy, which was the standard of care at the time this trial was designed, or preoperative gemcitabine for 1 cycle followed by gemcitabine and concurrent radiation, 1 more cycle of gemcitabine, surgery, and then adjuvant gemcitabine chemotherapy. Now, I should point out that the radiation in this study was a very non-standard 36 gray in 15 fractions, or 2.4 gray per fraction. Also pointing out, about half the patients were resectable at the time of enrollment, and half the patients were classified as borderline resectable. This table here shows basically compliance. Patients in the preoperative arm underwent diagnostic laparoscopy, and ultimately only 76% of those patients started preoperative therapy because the other ones were ruled out because of detection of occult metastases. 69% received surgery, 61% ultimately had a resection, and postoperative chemotherapy was started in about 46% of patients. Now, looking at the surgery followed by chemotherapy arm, 95% went to surgery, but only 72% had resection, and only 50% ultimately had postoperative chemotherapy. So ultimately, it was very similar to the number of patients who started adjuvant chemotherapy. So what's interesting here? You have the results of the patients with resectable disease, 133 patients. You can see that there is no difference with preoperative chemoradiation for R0 resection rate, although slightly higher than compared to upfront surgery, but no difference in overall survival, disease-free survival, freedom from local failure, or freedom from distant metastases. But what is interesting is if you look at patients with borderline resectable disease, 113 patients, there is a tremendous difference, a tremendous benefit for preoperative chemoradiation for R0 resection rate, 79% versus 13%. A benefit in overall survival, slight benefit in disease-free survival, benefit and freedom from local recurrence, but no difference in distant metastases. So these results are really some of the first prospective data to show the benefit of preoperative chemoradiation in the borderline resectable setting, which may point to the effectiveness of radiation in being able to sterilize the surgical margin. And here are the results showing for the overall group, showing overall survival, which was near significant, p-value of 0.096. Disease-free survival was significant. Local failure freedom interval was significant, but distant metastases-free interval was not significant. At ASTRO recently, the group did report a subgroup analysis of patients where they looked only at patients who underwent the either preoperative chemoradiation, surgery, and then started adjuvant chemoradiation. So this was about 46% of patients compared to about the 51% of patients who were randomized to surgery and adjuvant chemotherapy who actually started adjuvant chemotherapy. So the idea here was that this was an apples to apples comparison of patients who were able to get all the way through treatment and start the adjuvant chemotherapy. So these are the best of the best in both treatment arms. And you can see that even with this high degree of selection, patients randomized to the preoperative chemoradiation arm had a significant benefit in overall survival with a median survival of 42.1 months for preoperative chemoradiation compared to 19 months. So my pancreatic cancer takeaway points are: systemic therapy has significantly improved in the recent decade. Radiotherapy may play a more important role due to better systemic control now that we can achieve it. Radiotherapy has been controversial previously due to negative studies from older trials using very outdated and likely ineffective chemotherapy. So I contend that radiotherapy should be retested in the setting of modern chemotherapy. And hypofractionated radiotherapy courses should continue to be explored as a way to be able to maintain the cadence and the delivery of full dose chemotherapy and deliver higher doses of radiation. So my treatment guidelines for pancreatic cancer are, well, first off, it is still highly controversial and thus highly variable in many aspects, but this is my own, these are my own personal opinions. For resectable disease, upfront surgery followed by adjuvant chemotherapy, which should be FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine. Following completion of chemotherapy, if the patients continue to have systemically controlled disease, I would offer radiotherapy for patients with positive nodes or positive margins. However, I would also recommend that we move more towards preoperative therapy, starting with chemotherapy, which again should probably be FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine, if possible. I would follow up with radiation, followed then by surgery, and then possibly adjuvant chemotherapy if there is still more chemotherapy to give. In the borderline resectable setting, although I acknowledge that chemotherapy alone is used out there, I would strongly recommend using chemotherapy as well as radiation therapy to best sterilize the margin. This would be followed by surgery and then possibly adjuvant chemotherapy. And in the locally advanced setting, chemotherapy is the standard of care. Again, FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine. At our institution, we would certainly consider radiotherapy after the completion of chemotherapy if the patients continue to have localized disease only. The final topic is biliary tract cancers. And that represents really three major categories: extrahepatic, intrahepatic, and gallbladder cancers. So with adjuvant therapy, so the best study that I turned to look at patterns of failure is actually this one from Memorial Sloan Kettering back in 2003. They looked at isolated first site of recurrence for hilar cholangiocarcinoma versus gallbladder cancer. And as you can see, hilar cholangiocarcinomas had near 60% rate of isolated local regional failure as the first site of recurrence, compared to only 40% for distant. That gets flipped with gallbladder cancer, where the rate of local regional failure was only 15%, but a much higher rate of distant progression. And so these results strongly imply different types of adjuvant therapy would apply for these different types of cancers. Now, up until recently, we don't have really any randomized trials for adjuvant therapy for biliary tract cancers, so there have been a number of these systematic reviews and meta-analyses. And one of the best ones that I could find, at least that's the most useful to me, is this one from 2012, where they looked at 20 studies from 1960 all the way to 2010, including gallbladder or cholangiocarcinomas. 6,700 patients were included, and they found overall there was a near significant improvement in survival with adjuvant therapy compared to observation, p-value of 0.06. Chemotherapy or chemoradiation were better than radiation therapy alone. And the benefit for adjuvant therapy seemed to be most pronounced in the group that were node positive or with R1 resection, so very classic at-risk features in the adjuvant setting. However, there was no survival difference with adjuvant therapy based on the disease site. But there was not enough data to answer the most important question, which is there a difference between adjuvant chemo versus chemo radiation? So that question still remains unanswered. The first prospective randomized trial for adjuvant therapy for biliary tract cancers was the BILCAP trial, first published last year. It randomized patients after resection to observation or 8 cycles of capecitabine. The results showed that by intention to treat, the overall survival did favor capecitabine, but the p-value was not significant at 0.097. However, on a per-protocol analysis, the survival difference actually was significant at 0.028. However, keep in mind that whenever you do a per-protocol analysis, when the control arm is observation, you're really only favoring the experimental arm. So that should not be a surprise that the p-value turned out to be significant. By intention to treat, relapse-free survival was significant, and similarly by per-protocol analysis, it was also significant. When you look at subgroup analysis, a couple interesting things. A second prospective randomized trial was published last year, the PRODIGE 12 trial, which randomized patients with resected biliary tract cancers to either surveillance or combination gemcitabine oxaliplatin. But unlike the BILCAP trial, there was no sign of a benefit with the addition of adjuvant chemotherapy in relapse-free survival or overall survival, which is quite puzzling. One would think that the gemcitabine oxaliplatin combination would be more potent than Xeloda, but that was not seen in this trial. And similarly, if you look at the subgroup analysis, there isn't much that one can make of this. We thought that gallbladder cancer may have a higher risk of systemic disease, but you can see that group actually, the results seem to favor surveillance over gem oxaliplatin. So these results are actually pretty puzzling and further muddied the waters on the role of adjuvant chemotherapy. We do know that there are more active agents for biliary tract cancers. The ABC trial, published about 10 years ago now, randomized patients to gemcitabine cisplatin versus gemcitabine alone, showing improved overall survival and progression-free survival. And that regimen has actually been used also sometimes in the adjuvant setting. A trial that radiation oncologists can use to support the role of adjuvant chemoradiation is the SWOG 0809 trial. This was a single-arm phase 2 trial, however, so it does not compare the role of radiotherapy compared to chemotherapy. But it took patients with gallbladder or extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma status post-resection, T2 to T4, N1 or R1 patients. All patients received gemcitabine and capecitabine for 4 cycles, followed then by concurrent chemoradiation with capecitabine. They treated elective nodal fields to 45 gray and boosted the tumor bed up to 54 to 59.4 gray. And the results are shown here. 2-year estimate of overall survival was 65%. And you can see that by resection status, there was no difference. So one could possibly interpret this as saying that the radiotherapy was able to negate the negative prognostic effect of an R1 resection. Looking at the patterns of failure here, you can see that the results are similar to the previous paper from Memorial Sloan Kettering. You can see that for patients with distal or hilar cholangiocarcinomas, the rate of local failure or local plus distant failure were higher than for gallbladder cancer, whereas for gallbladder cancer, the rate of distant failure was much higher than it was for hilar or distal cholangiocarcinomas. If you want some data to support adjuvant chemoradiation for gallbladder cancer, you could point to this study from the SEER Medicare database, which of course comes with many well-known caveats. But investigators here did seem to show that when they compared results to chemotherapy or observation, chemoradiation actually improved survival for patients who had either T2 or higher disease or N-positive disease. Now, again, it is SEER Medicare, but it is data that one can use to support the role of adjuvant radiation for gallbladder cancer. So moving on finally to definitive therapy, stereotactic body radiotherapy has become used for unresectable intrahepatic or unresectable extrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas. This is a study from MD Anderson showing that dose escalation improved survival, and they found that a BED of 80.5 gray was an important cutoff, both for local control and survival. And 80.5 gray translates to about 43.5 gray in 5 fractions. Similarly, a study from Germany retrospectively looked at 64 patients with 82 lesions with either intrahepatic or extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, and they found that 76 gray was an important cut point for local control, and that translates to 41.5 gray in 5 fractions, and they found that 91 gray BED, which translates to 47 gray in 5 fractions, was an important cut point for overall survival. So my takeaway points are, the role of adjuvant radiotherapy for biliary tract cancers is undefined, but adjuvant radiotherapy seems most indicated for Hyalur cholangiocarcinoma, node-positive disease, or margin-positive disease, and in the definitive setting, there appears to be a benefit to dose escalation. So my treatment recommendations are, in the adjuvant setting, after chemotherapy, I would add adjuvant chemoradiation for N-positive or R1 disease, and I would treat 45 gray and 25 fractions to the tumor bed and elective nodes, which would include the porta hepatis, celiac, superior mesenteric artery, and para-aortic lymph nodes. And I would boost the primary based on margin status to anywhere from 50 to 56 gray. And in the definitive setting, I would try to use hypofractionated or stereotactic ablative radiotherapy as to a BED as high as possible, but I try to get at least 45 gray and 5 fractions or equivalent. Thank you again for listening and allowing me to speak, and I'm happy to take questions during the live Q&A session. Thank you.